excitement, then nodded. And how long will it take to make it? 20 minutes, if everything goes right. Alistair exhaled. All right, he said. 20 minutes it is. After that, I'm going to find Cordelia. At Thomas's puzzled look, he gestured impatiently toward the steps that went down to the laboratory. I'll help you, he said. Let's get to work. The mandacore was massive. It rose over them like the shadow of a bonfire. There was no mistaking it. Though it had grown tremendously in size, it had the same scaled, lion-shaped body, the same triple row of fanged jaws. There was something else about it that was new too. Here, in the shadow realm, its body was marked with 1,000 kinds of disease. As it moved toward them, its claws tearing the sand, Cordelia felt herself gag. Demons, as a group, were often disgusting. One trained oneself to cope with the horror. But there was something visceral about the markers of death that covered this creature. The ugly buboes of the Black Death decorated its arms, while its torso was bumped with smallpox, its chest cracked and runneled with leprosy. Patches of its skin were eaten away with acidic rot, while others were red with scarlet fever. Black ichor dripped from its ears and mouth. James backed up, pulling Cordelia with him, but sand and dirt had piled up all around them in sheer-sided dunes. There was no real way to retreat. A sharp laugh rang out. Standing atop one of the dunes of sand was a man with pale grey hair and eyes. He looked young and startlingly beautiful, but there was a dark edge to his beauty. It was like the loveliness of blood in snow, or the gleam of white bone through shadow. He resembled James. Not in any specific way, but the shape of his eyes, perhaps, the bones in his face, the curve of his mouth. She had to remind herself. This is Belial, Prince of Hell. If he reminds you of James, that is deliberate on his part. In his true form, he may look nothing like this. As the dust settled around them, he held out a hand toward the mandacore demon. The demon seemed to freeze in place as Belial turned to regard Cordelia with a cold gaze. Tisk, tisk, James, he said. Bringing in reinforcements like this is cheating. What of the rules of fair play? James drew a gleaming short sword from his weapons belt. He was breathing hard and very pale. Streaked with dirt and sand, he no longer looked like a young Edwardian gentleman, but something more primal than that. Let her go back to our world, he said. Just leave her be. I'm the one you have business with. No, Cordelia said sharply. I won't abandon you. Belial made a bored gesture, a lazy flick of the wrist. Cordelia gasped as black vines exploded from the earth, twining around her feet and legs, pinning her in place. James took a step toward her. She raised Cortana and brought it down, intending to slice through the vines. The blade vanished from her hand. She overbalanced, falling to her knees. The vines twisted tighter around her legs, and she choked down a scream. The pain was agonizing, turning her vision red. She heard James shout something and looked up through blurred eyes to see Belial smiling a terrible smile, Cortana gripped in his hand. He laughed at her expression. In this realm, all things obey me, he said, even a blade of Wayland the Smith. He snapped his fingers, the sound loud as a gunshot. The mandacore demon reared back and sprang at James. James rolled to the side as the mandacore demon sprang. He heard it hit the ground beside him, sending shockwaves through the sand and dirt. He rolled onto his back as it rose up over him, stabbing upward with his sword. He heard a grunt, and burning ichor spattered his arm. The demon reared back, giving him just enough room to spring to his feet. He could see Cordelia struggling desperately against the vines. James somersaulted forward, rolling over and over until he shot to his feet and spun around. The manticore was behind him, swinging a mace-like clubbed paw. James ducked as it whistled overhead, just missing him. His head ached and throbbed. His skin felt hot and tight, his wrist a burning agony. He backed up, trying to center his vision on the manticore. It was a shadow moving against a brighter light that hurt his eyes. Belial watched intently as the manticore circled, growling. Cordelia screamed a warning. The manticore had leaped into the air. It was peculiarly swift, despite its sores and wounds, claws outstretched. One raked James's arm. He spun sideways, blade whipping overhead, slashing across the demon's torso. More ichor splashed him, mixing with his own blood now. He tasted metal in his mouth and rolled into a crouch that spun into a lunge. The manticore threw up a clawed fist, catching at the blade of his sword. It howled, its skin sliced open as it gripped the blade and shoved, hurling James backwards. He hit the ground with enough force to knock his breath out of him. His sword skidded from his hand. He reached for it just as one of the manticore's feet slammed down on the blade. He rolled to the side as a racking cough seized him. Crawling to his knees, he spit up blood. He could hear Belial laughing. He wiped the blood from his mouth. The demon had reared up over him to its full height. It looked down through slitted red eyes. "Give up, James," Belial said. "Concede defeat, or I will order the manticore to strike you down." James rose painfully to his knees. He saw Cordelia, her hands bloody from tearing at the vines. He wanted to apologize to her, to tell her he was sorry for dragging her into this hopeless mess. She looked at him. It was as if she was trying to tell him something, trying to speak to him with her eyes. Her hands still gripped the vines. She hadn't given up, despite the blood, despite the pain. She was Cordelia. She would never give up. "Fight on," he told himself. But he couldn't rise. His body was shutting down. Shadows had begun to creep in at the edge of his vision. The manticore hovered above him, waiting for a word, a gesture from Belial. Belial, who ruled over all this place, who bent this realm to his will. James stretched out his right arm. The slash made by the manticore's claw was still bleeding freely. Drops struck the ground, and the sand drank them up. He thought he could hear the sand whispering, a soft murmur of sound. But perhaps it was only the poison in his body. "Shadows," the sand whispered. And James thought of all the things Jem had ever taught him. Focus, clarity, breathing. "You must build a fortress of control around yourself. You must come to know this power so that you may master it." Belial had mastered this world. He had bent everything in it to his will. "Every tree, every rock, every grain of sand is under my command." Each part of this realm responded to that which made Belial himself. "Are you not my heir, my own flesh and blood?" James focused. He drew all his concentration down like light drawn through a magnifying glass. He bore down with his will, with his resolve, with the blood in his veins. He felt the ground shift and change beneath him. He reached out for the substance of this realm itself, the petrified wood of the gnarled trees, the teetering piles of bones, the dunes of sand, the shadow of the manticore. Belial cried out. The manticore demon surged upward. James bolted to his feet. He was funneling his own strength into the realm around him, and it responded with alacrity. The earth roared under his feet. The air exploded like dark fire from his hands, his fingers. The mandacles staggered toward James, but the wind was full of swirling sand, creating a dark tornado. Belial shouted, but the mandacle could no longer hear him. His voice was lost in the tearing wind. James stood with his arms flung wide to either side, wind and sand tearing around him like a storm in the desert. The mandacle was howling and howling now. The whole substance of the realm had turned against it. Branches sheared free of trees, flying through the air like knives. Bones became missiles. The demon gave one last howl as the dark, churning air rose up in a circle around it before plunging inward, crushing and tearing. The mandacle vanished. Instantly, James let go. The wind quieted, the earth stilling under his feet. Debris pattered softly to the ground. He wiped sand and blood from his eyes, casting around desperately. The whole landscape had changed. The dunes had shifted. The sand had flattened out in front of him. He saw Cordelia then. She was lying, motionless, her red hair like a splash of blood against the sand. "Daisy," James said hoarsely, and started forward. He barely took a single step. Belial appeared in front of him, though he had not been there a moment ago. There were no tracks in the sand to show that he had crossed it to get to James. In his left hand, he clutched Cortana, its deep golden blade shining against his grey skin. "Well," Belial said, his face twisting into an approximation of a smile. "How very, very clever you are." James only stared. He could feel the exhaustion, the poison in his veins, waiting to rush back to claim him. He was desperate to get to Cordelia before he collapsed. "Get out of my way," he snarled, his voice rasping out of his dry throat. Belial chuckled. "Resist the devil and he will flee from you. It's a nice thought, isn't it? From the Book of James, too." He leaned toward James, and James could smell the burnt chalk scent of him. "I see that you begin to understand a fraction of the power you could have if you embraced your true heritage," he whispered. "The blood you share with me is far more powerful than the blood you share with Raziel. What power do you think you will have if you remain what you are now?" "Let me be," James said hoarsely. "I won't let you." "Enough," Belial roared. It was as if the demon had lost control of the features of his face. His eyes appeared strangely elongated, as did his mouth, stretching and stretching across his chin in a snarl of terrible rage. "You think I would allow you to let this body die? You have no choice. You..." Belial's left arm jerked backward. James's eyes widened as Cortana flew from Belial's hand, ripping free of his clawed fingers. Belial cried out, twisting around to see what James himself had only just seen. Cordelia standing behind them, her gear shredded from the knees down. Cortana flew to her like a bird. She reached out for her blade, and it thumped home against her bloody palm. "It's very rude to take someone else's sword without asking," she said. Belial's eyes narrowed. He raised his hand, and the ground under Cordelia's feet began to crack open. James staggered forward blindly, meaning to catch her before she fell, but Cordelia was steady on her feet. She sprang toward Belial, driving Cortana into the demon's chest in a single, smooth motion. Belial threw back his head and roared in agony. "Daisy!" James darted forward as Cordelia wrenched the sword back. Belial was still howling. Blood spilled from the wound, the colour of dark rubies, a shimmering red-black. James seized hold of Cordelia, who was gasping and shaking. Her eyes were fixed on Belial.
"Fools!" Belial hissed. "You have no idea what you've done!"
He raised a hand as if he meant to strike one of them, but it crumbled away like sand. Belial gaped as his body shuddered into pieces, like a child's puzzle tossed haphazardly in the air. He opened his mouth as if to roar or scream, but his face caved in before he could make a sound. He crumbled, dissolving against the air, as James stared in horror. Cordelia cried out. The ground heaved under them. The sky began to crack, red-black light pouring from the fissures like the blood from Belial's wound. The realm was crumbling around them. James pulled Cordelia toward him as the bottom fell out of the world. It was not like travelling by portal, Lucy thought, a whirlwind of sound and sight. The path the dead travelled was utterly silent and utterly dark. She could neither see nor hear anything at all. If it were not for Jesse's arms around her, the solid feel of his body, she might have thought she had lost the living world forever, that she had died, or been spun away into a terrible, featureless void. The feeling of relief when the world opened back up again was immense. Solid ground struck her feet. She stumbled and was steadied by the arms around her. She blinked the dizziness out of her eyes and looked around. She saw Jesse first. He held her close, but the expression in his green eyes was absolutely furious. "God damn you, Lucy Herondale," he said, and turned her loose.
"Jesse,"
she began, and realized she had no idea where she was. She looked around wildly. They were in a clearing in the middle of Highgate Cemetery, under a canopy of cedar trees. It was dark, the gaps between the leaves overhead letting in little starlight. Lucy took a witchlight out of her pocket with shaking hands. Light blazed up. Now she could see tombs standing around them in a ring. The earth here was torn, churned up as if there had been a recent fight. Lying in the grass some distance away was a crumpled figure. Lucy gasped.
"Matthew!"
She tore across the clearing and threw herself down next to James's parapet eye. In the glow of the witchlight, she could see the bruises on his face. His jacket and shirt were ripped and spattered with blood. She fumbled her steely out of her belt, reaching for his hand. His parapet eye rune stood out stark and black on the inside of his wrist. Lucy bit back tears. "Lucy?" Jesse stood over her. Wind was rattling the leaves overhead, but neither his clothes nor hair moved in the breeze. "He's all right. Unconscious, but not in danger." She pressed the tip of the steely to Matthew's palm and drew a quick erazzi.
"How do you know?"
"If he were dying, I would see it," Jesse said quietly, "and he would see me." Lucy finished the erazzi and saw it burn to life on Matthew's skin. He moaned and stirred, his eyes fluttering open.
"Matthew,"
she said, leaning over him. She slipped the steely back into her belt and laid her hand against his cheek, where the bruises and scratches were beginning to fade. His eyes fastened on her, pupils wide and unfocused.
"Cordelia,"
he whispered. She blinked.
"Math, no," she said. "It's Lucy."
She took his hand.
"Where is Cordelia? And James? Matthew, where are they?"
He started to struggle into a sitting position. "The archway," he said. And Lucy stared at him in puzzlement. "They went through. James first, and then Cordelia. She used Cortana." His dark green gaze darted around the clearing. "The archway," he said again, a note of panic in his voice. Where is it? Worried, Lucy glanced at Jesse. His jaw was still set with anger, but he hadn't walked away, at least. He hadn't disappeared on her. He shrugged. Clearly he hadn't seen an archway either.
Matthew, try to remember,
she began. And then the sky tore, silently and unbelievably down the middle. For a moment there was a gap in the centre of the sky, and through it Lucy could see the constellations of another world. She saw shadows that rose into the air like towers of starfire, darkly blazing. For a moment she glimpsed a pair of silver eyes. Then James and Cordelia hurtled out of the sky. Cordelia fell first. She sprang into existence like a falling star, appearing between one moment and the next, 10 feet above the ground. She struck the earth hard, Cortana flying from her hand. James followed a moment later, his body limp. He hit the ground beside Cordelia and lay motionless. Get me up, Matthew said, gripping Lucy's hand. As Jesse watched, Lucy helped Matthew to his feet. James and Cordelia were lying a few yards away. Lucy and Matthew ran to kneel down beside them. Cordelia was already struggling to get up. She was filthy with sand and dirt. Her hair had come out of its fastenings and spilled down over her shoulders like fire. James, she gasped, her dark eyes wide with fear. See to him. Please, not me. The demon poison.
Demon poison?
Cold all over, Lucy bent over her brother. He lay unmoving, his hands black with ichor, perfectly pale and still. His wild black hair was stiff with blood. Cordelia tried to rise to her feet, but screamed out in pain and collapsed back to her knees. Lucy, kneeling over James, looked at her with sudden panic.
Daisy?
It's nothing, Cordelia said. Please, there must be something we can do for James. She drew in a shuddering breath. He killed the Mandacore. He destroyed it. He can't die. It's not fair. Matthew was kneeling by James's side, his steely already in his hand. Runes given by one's parabatai were always the most powerful. Matthew's hands were steady as he scrolled healing runes over James's hands, his wrists, the base of his throat. They all froze, holding their breath. Cordelia, painfully, pulled herself closer, her scarlet hair hanging down to touch the green leaves on the ground. Her gaze was fixed on James. The Arazis on his skin shimmered and vanished. They won't work. It was Jesse. The anger had left his face now. He stood near Cordelia, unseen by anyone but Lucy, and there was a terrible sorrow in his eyes. He is too close to death. Matthew gasped. His hand flew to his chest. He pressed there, hard, as if a knife had gone into his heart and he was trying to stop the bleeding. His face was utterly white. He's dying, he said, his voice cracking. I can feel it. Lucy caught at her brother's hands. They were cold in hers, unmoving. Tears spilled from her eyes and onto his face, tracing tracks in the grime.
Please, Jamie, she whispered. Please don't die. Please take another breath. For Mum and Papa. For me.
Give him mine, said Jesse. Lucy's head jerked up. She stared at Jesse. There was an odd look on his face, a strange, almost luminous resignation.
What do you mean?
Cordelia stared. Who are you talking to? Lucy? Jesse moved toward them. He knelt down, and the grass did not bend under the weight of his body. He drew the gold chain of his locket over his head and held it out to Lucy. She remembered what he had said after the fight on Tower Bridge, that he would have given his last breath to her. that it would have enough life force to empty her lungs of water if she had been drowning, as James was drowning in poison now.
"But what will happen to you?"
she whispered. She was aware that Cordelia was staring at her. Matthew was doubled up in agony, his breaths coming in ragged gasps. "Does it matter?" said Jessie. "This is his life, not a shadow of a life, not years of waiting in the dark." Lucy reached out her hand. It closed around the locket, and she felt it tumble into her palm, cool and solid. For a moment she hesitated, just for a moment, her eyes fixed on Jessie, kneeling in the grass. Then she looked down at her brother. His lips were blue, his eyes sunken into his head. He was barely breathing. Carefully, as if she were holding a glass containing the last drop of water in the world, Lucy opened the little locket and pressed the curve of the metal against his lips. There was a pause, enough time for a sigh. Then her brother's chest lifted with Jessie Blackthorne's last breath. His eyes opened, bright gold, and from the four crescent wounds in his wrist, black fluid spilled. His body was ridding itself of the Mandacore's poison. Lucy's hand closed tightly around the locket, so tightly the edge of the metal cut into her palm. Cordelia cried out. Matthew lifted his head, the colour returning to his face. He scrambled to James's side and pulled James into his lap. James, slumped against Matthew's chest, struggled to focus. Lucy knew what he was seeing. A boy leaning over him. A boy with hair as black as his own, a boy with green eyes the colour of hawthorn leaves, a boy who was already beginning to fade around the edges, like a figure seen in a cloud that disappears when the wind changes. "Who are you?" James whispered, his voice ragged. But Jessie was already gone. "What do you mean, who are you?" Matthew demanded. "I'm your Parabatai, you nitwit." He was busy drawing healing runes on whatever parts of James he could reach, which Cordelia could only applaud. She had no idea what Lucy had done to heal her brother, but that was not what mattered now. "I didn't mean you, Matthew," James said. His eyes were closed, his dark lashes feathered against the tops of his cheekbones. "Obviously." Matthew ran a ringed hand through James's wild hair and smiled. "Are you going to tell us what happened yet? It isn't every day a fellow goes into a demon realm and then falls out of the sky. I'd think you'd want to share this experience with your friends." "Believe me when I say it is a long story," said James. "I promise you, we are in no danger now."
"Did you really kill the Mandacore?" asked Lucy.
"Yes," said James, "and Cordelia destroyed the one who raised it." He held out a hand, scarred with cuts and filthy with dirt. "Daisy, would you come here?" He smiled crookedly. "I would come to you, but I do not think I have the strength to walk." Cordelia tried to rise, but a white hot pain shot up her leg. She bit down on a whimper.
"My leg is broken, I think. Very vexing, but I'm quite all right." "Oh, Daisy, your leg!"
Lucy leaped to her feet and raced over to Cordelia, dropping down and pressing her steely against Cordelia's arm. She began to draw an Arazi.
"I am the worst," she moaned. "The most dreadful would-be Parabatai who ever lived. Please forgive me, Daisy."
As the healing rune took effect, Cordelia could feel the bone in her leg beginning to knit back together. It was not an entirely pleasant feeling. She gasped and said,
"Lucy, it's nothing. I would have done it myself, but I dropped my steely in that other place."
Lucy pushed Cordelia's hair out of her eyes and smiled at her.
"There is no need ever to do it yourself," she said. "Runes given to you by your Parabatai are best."
ghastly, said Matthew. Look at them, affirming their eternal bond of friendship. In public.
I would question your definition of public, said James.
Lucy and Cordelia exchanged a smile. If James was capable of mocking Matthew, he was certainly on the mend.
This is a mostly deserted graveyard.
Hmm, said Matthew, in a surprisingly serious tone. His eyes narrowed. He rose to his feet, helping James to sit up against a tree. As Matthew paced to the edge of the clearing, James said, Luce, let me talk to Cordelia for a moment. Lucy exchanged a glance with Cordelia, who nodded and stood up. It still hurt to put weight on her leg, but Lucy's aratzes had mostly done their job. Lucy went to join Matthew as Cordelia limped over to James and sank down beside him under the shadow of a cypress tree. For a moment, as James's breaths had faded, Cordelia had seen life fork into two paths. One path in which James was dead, in which there was no meaning in the world, in which Lucy was heartbroken and Matthew destroyed, in which Thomas and Christopher were crushed, and the Herondale family never smiled again. And a second path, in which life continued as it was now, imperfect, confusing, but full of hope. They were on the second path. That was what mattered, that James was breathing, that his lips were no longer blue, that he was looking at her with steady gold eyes. Despite the fact that her whole body ached, she found herself smiling. You saved my life, he said, just as you saved my sister's all those years ago. We should have given you a more warrior-like nickname. Not Daisy, but Artemis or Boadicea. She laughed softly.
I like Daisy.
So do I, he said, and reached up to lightly brush back a strand of her hair. She felt her heart nearly stop. In a low voice, he said, and when her cheek the moon revealed, 1,000 hearts were won. No pride, no shield could check her power. Layla, she was called.
Layla and Majnun, she whispered. You remember?
You read it to me, he said. Perhaps, now all this is over, we could read it again, together.
Reading together. Never had Cordelia heard of anything so romantic.
She started to nod, just as Matthew called out sharply, Someone's coming! I see witch light! Cordelia turned to look. Lights had appeared between the trees. As they came nearer, she saw the glimmer of torchlight. She tried to rise, but the aratzes were already fading. Her leg hurt too much. She sat back down.
Oh dear, said Lucy. The Silent Brothers aren't going to be at all pleased, are they? Nor the Enclave. We're probably going to be in awful trouble.
Maybe we could leg it, suggested Matthew.
I am not going anywhere, said James. I will remain here and take whatever punishment is given out. The rack, the Iron Maiden, death by spiders. Anything but getting up.
I don't think I can stand up, said Cordelia apologetically. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy, Matthew intoned. Coleridge. Wordsworth, James corrected. The lights swung closer. A sharp voice cut through the clearing. A familiar voice. What on earth is going on? Cordelia twisted around, trying not to move her leg. Alistair strode into the clearing. He looked disarmingly normal in an old tweed coat of her father's, as if he'd been out for a stroll. His unnaturally pale hair gleamed under the faint starlight. Beside him was Thomas, his hair mussed, carrying what looked like an apothecary's case. Why are you all on the ground? Said Thomas, and then waved his case in the air. The antidote, it's ready. What's the quickest way to Christopher? There was a babble of voices. Matthew got to his feet and hugged Thomas hard, being careful not to knock the case out of his hand. "Let's go alert the brothers," he said, and began to pull his friend toward the path leading to the Silent City.
"You needn't come with me," Thomas protested, amused.
"Just in case there's chanting," Matthew said. "I don't think there will be, mind, but you never know." Alistair had been watching as Thomas and Matthew disappeared into the shadows between the trees. He shook his head and turned his attention back to Cordelia.
"Bi,"
he said, bending down to swing her up in his arms. "Come along home." In surprise, she looped an arm around his neck.
"But Alistair, I can't leave my friends."
"Leila," Alistair said, in an unusually gentle voice. "They're not going to be alone. Thomas and I took care of sending a message to the Institute. Look." She looked and saw that the broad path behind the tombs was full of the glow of witchlight torches borne by a crowd of shadow hunters. She recognized a dozen familiar faces. Will Herondale, his torch casting bright illumination over his black and silver hair. Tessa, a sword in her hand, her brown hair loose over her shoulders. Gabriel, Cecily, and Anna Lightwood. Anna smiling, her hair as black as the gear she wore. She heard Lucy give a short cry.
"Papa!"
Will broke into a run. He caught hold of his daughter and swept her into his arms. Tessa ran to James, dropping down to kneel beside him and fuss over his bruises and cuts. Gabriel and Cecily followed, and soon Lucy and James were surrounded, being embraced and scolded in equal measure. Cordelia closed her eyes in relief. James and Lucy were all right. Everywhere Cordelia could hear chatter. Gabriel and Cecily were asking after Thomas, and the others were saying that he was being taken to the Silent City now, where the antidote would be administered. Someone else, one of the Rosewains, was saying that there was still a present danger, that the demons might attack again, whether there was an antidote or not.
"The Mandacore has been defeated," Cordelia said. "It will not return."
"And how do you know that, young lady?" said George Penhallow.
"Because James killed it,"
Cordelia said as loudly as she could.
"James killed the Mandacore demon. I saw it die."
At that point, several people crowded toward her. It was Will who blocked their way, his hand out, protesting that they should not be bothering an injured girl. Alistair took the opportunity to slip from the clearing and into the shadows, still carrying Cordelia in his arms.
"I beg you not to get involved, Kohari Azizam," said Alistair. "It will all be sorted out soon enough, but there's going to be a great deal of nonsense first, and you need to rest."
"But they need to know it was James," Cordelia said. It was oddly comfortable to be carried like this, with her head against her brother's shoulder,
the way her father had carried her once when she was very small.
"They need to know what he did, because they do. Because Belial is his grandfather," she thought. "Because when the Enclave finds that out, who knows what they will think? Because people can be foolish and cruel."
"They will," Alistair said, sounding utterly confident. "The truth is the truth. It will always come out." She craned her head back to look up at him.
"How do you know the antidote works?"
Alistair grinned in the dark.
"I have faith in Thomas."
"You do?" said Cordelia. "I didn't think you even knew him that well."
Alistair hesitated.
"I watched him make it," he said finally.
They had reached the Carstairs carriage now, with its design of castle towers on the door. Many more carriages lined the curb beside it.
"Because he had such faith in Christopher, he had faith in himself."
"I never quite thought of friendship like that, as something that makes you more than you are."
"But Alistair..."
"No more questions," said Alistair, placing Cordelia inside the carriage and swinging himself up after her.
He smiled, that rare, charming smile of his that was all the better for its rarity. You were very brave, Leila, but you need healing too. Time to go home. Days passed. Cirencworth Hall, 1898. Cordelia often felt alone when it was just her and her parents, but never as much as when Alistair went away to the academy. While he was gone, the rest of the Carstairs family travelled to India, to Paris, to Cape Town and Canada, but they were at Cirencworth for the holidays when he finally returned. She had waited months for his return, but when he stepped out of the carriage, taller, more angular, and sharper than ever, he seemed like a different person. He'd always been short-tempered and prickly, but now he would barely speak to her. When he did, it was mostly to tell her not to bother him. Her parents ignored the transformation. When Cordelia asked her father why Alistair wouldn't spend time with her, he smiled at her and told her that teenage boys went through times like this, and she would understand when she was older. He's been having fun with boys his own age all year, and now he's got to be back in the countryside with the likes of us, Elias said with a chuckle. He'll get over it. This was not a satisfying answer. Cordelia tried to put herself in Alistair's path as much as she could, to force him to acknowledge her. Often, though, she couldn't even find him. He spent hours locked in his bedroom, and when she knocked on the door, he didn't even bother to tell her to go away. He just ignored her. The only way she knew he'd been in there was when he emerged to eat, or to announce he was going out for a long walk by himself. This went on for a few weeks. Cordelia's feelings changed from disappointment to sorrow, to blaming herself, to annoyance, and then to anger. At dinner one night, she threw a spoon at him and shouted, "Why won't you talk to me?" Alistair caught the spoon out of the air, put it down on the table, and glared at her in silence. "Don't throw things, Cordelia," her mother said.
"Maman!"
Cordelia protested in a tone of betrayal. Her father ignored the entire business and went on eating as though nothing had happened. Risa glided by and set a new spoon down at Cordelia's place, which Cordelia found extremely irritating. Alistair's refusal to engage with Cordelia was, she understood, meant to cause her to give up and stop trying. So she redoubled her efforts.
"Well," she would announce, if she found herself in the same room with him, "I'm going to collect wild blackberries down the lane."
Alistair loved blackberries.
Or, "I think I'll do some tumbling in the training room after lunch."
Alistair was always on her to practice how to fall safely, and she'd need a partner for that. One day, when he went out for one of his walks, Cordelia waited a minute and then followed. It was good practice, she told herself. Stealthy movement, awareness of her surroundings, honing her senses. She made it a game. How long could she track her brother before he noticed? Could she remain undetected long enough to find out where he went? It turned out Alistair didn't go anywhere. He just walked and walked, knowing these woods well enough not to get lost. Cordelia began to get tired after a couple of hours. Then she began to get hungry. Then she got distracted and hooked her foot into a protruding tree root and fell in a thud on the hard-packed dirt. Ahead, Alistair turned at the noise and spotted her as she, annoyed, scrambled to her feet. She folded her arms and held up her chin, stubborn and determined to retain her pride in the face of whatever unpleasant reaction he was preparing. His contempt, his rage, his dismissal. Instead, he let out a sigh and walked over to her. Without preamble, he said gruffly, "Are you hurt?" Cordelia lifted her foot and wiggled it experimentally.
"I'll be okay. Just bruised, I think."
"Come on," he said. "Let's go home." They walked in silence, Alistair a few steps ahead, not speaking. Eventually, driven mad by the silence, Cordelia burst out,
Don't you want to know why I was following you?
He turned and considered her. I assume you thought I was coming out here to do something exciting.
I'm sorry, she said, growing, as always, more agitated in the face of Alistair's imperturbable calm. I'm sorry that since you went away to the academy you've become all grown up and mature and you have fancy new friends. I'm sorry I'm just your stupid little sister.
Alistair stared at her a moment, and then let out a bark of laughter. There was no humour in it.
You have no idea what you're talking about. I'm sorry you're too good for your family now. I'm sorry you're too good to train with me.
He shook his head, dismissive.
Don't be daft, Cordelia. Just talk to me, she said. I don't know why you're so grumpy. You're the lucky one who got to go away, who got to have fun in Idris. You know how alone I've been all year.
For a moment, Alistair looked lost, hesitant. It had been a long time since Cordelia had seen an expression so open on his face. Then he slammed shut like an iron gate. We're all of us alone, he said, in the end.
What does that mean? She demanded,
but he turned to walk away. After a moment, wiping the wetness from her face with her sleeve, she followed. When they got back to the house, she left him in the entryway while she retrieved the entire stock of throwing knives from the china cabinet that served as the house's armory. She walked past her brother on the way from cabinet to training room, glaring at him, barely able to carry the pile. He watched her in silence. In the training room, she sat up and went through her paces. Thunk, thunk. Throwing knives were not her strongest weapon, but she needed the sense of impact, of getting to hurt something, even just a target on a backstop. As usual, the rhythm of training soothed her. Her breathing became more calm and even. The repetition grounded her. 5 throws, then the walk to retrieve the knives from the target, and the walk back to try again. 5 throws, walk, retrieve, walk, 5 throws. After 20 minutes or so of this, she realised that Alistair was standing in the doorway of the training room. She ignored him. Someone else might have said that she had gotten better since he saw her last, or asked if he could take a turn. Alistair, though, eventually cleared his throat and said, "You're turning your left foot on the release. That's why you're so inconsistent." She glared and went back to throwing, but she paid more attention to her footwork. After a while, Alistair said, "It's stupid to say I'm lucky. I'm not lucky. You weren't stuck here all year." "Oh," Alistair sneered. "How many people came here this year to mock you? How many asked what was wrong with you that you didn't have a private tutor, or suggested your family was some kind of ne'er-do-wells because we've moved around a lot?" Cordelia looked over at him, expecting to see vulnerability and sadness there. But Alistair's eyes were hard, his mouth a thin line.
"They treated you badly."
Alistair let out another mirthless laugh.
"For a while. I realised I had a choice. There were only 2 kinds of people at the academy. The bullies and the bullied."
"And you?" Alistair said tightly. "Which would you have chosen?"
"If those were my only 2 choices," Cordelia said, "I would have left and come home."
"Yes, well," he said, "I chose the one where I wasn't made to feel like a laughing stock."
Cordelia was very still and silent.
Alistair's face was impassive.
"And how has that worked out?" she said, as mildly as she dared.
"Awful," he said. "It's awful."
Cordelia did not know what to say or what to do. She wanted to go and throw her arms around her brother, to tell him that she loved him. But he stood rigid, with his arms crossed in front of him, and she didn't dare.
Finally, she held out the knife in her hand.
"Do you want to have a throw? You're much better than I am."
When he looked suspicious, she said,
"I could use some help, Alistair. You see how careless my form is."
Alistair came and took the knife from her. "Very careless," he agreed. I know swordplay comes naturally to you, but not everything will. You must slow down. Pay attention to your feet. Now, follow my gestures. That's it, Leila. Stay with me. And she would. 21. Burn. My heart is bound by beauty's spell. My love is indestructible. Although I like a candle burn and almost to a shadow turn, I envy not the heart that's free, love's soul encircling chains for me. Nizami Ganjavi, Leila and Majnun. James lay on the bed in his room atop the covers, his arm flung behind his head. He was gazing at a familiar crack in the ceiling that was shaped a bit like a duck. His father would be horrified. Matthew sat beside him, wearing a velvet jacket and matching trousers. James had wavered in and out of consciousness for the first 2 days after his visit to Belial's realm. Sometimes he dreamed of the demon world and woke up yelling, reaching for a weapon that wasn't there. His knives might not have been beside him, but Matthew always was. If there was anyone in the world who understood about Parabatai, it was James's parents. On the first night of their return from Highgate, Matthew had dragged a pile of bedding into James's room, rolled himself up in it, and gone to sleep. No one tried to make him leave. When Tessa brought soup and tea to James, she brought some for Matthew, too. When Will came and brought card games to while away the time, Matthew played as well, and usually lost. Not that the others weren't kind as well. When Anna brought James a stylish new necktie to cheer him, she brought one for Matthew. When Lucy smuggled in midnight tarts from the kitchen, there were extras for Matthew. It was possible, as a result, that Matthew was never going home. James could hardly blame him. Charles had certainly been a pill lately. Everyone was hailing Christopher as a hero for having created the antidote to the Mandacore poison, a tale made even more romantic by the fact that Christopher had been stricken down and healed himself. Few knew Charles almost hadn't let Thomas use the lab to make it. The words, "If it hadn't been for Alistair Carstairs, everything would have been ruined," had actually passed Thomas's lips, causing James to wonder if he'd wandered back into the demon realm. Thomas and Christopher visited every day, carrying stories of the aftermath of the sickness. None of those who had been ill remembered chanting James's name, nor did Ariadne recall her brief possession. The quarantine had been lifted, and Charlotte and Henry were returning shortly. Christopher and James were currently both heroes, which angered James greatly as, he pointed out, Cordelia had been with him in the demon realm, and had it not been for her, he would have died. Lucy had also saved the day, as had Matthew. Thomas had helped retrieve the Malos root from Chiswick House and had made the antidote with his own hands. Anna had taken them to the Hell Ruel. They were all heroes, in his opinion. It was Matthew who asked him, when they were alone, if he thought he might be missing Cordelia. She alone hadn't come to visit him. The break in her leg was a bad one, it turned out, and would take several days to heal. Lucy had been to see her and reported her in good spirits. "I read to her from the beautiful Cordelia and she went right to sleep," Lucy said with delight. "So she must have been very tired." Thomas and Christopher had gone to see her as well and brought her chocolates. They asked James if he had anything he wanted them to bring to her with his compliments. He shook his head without speaking, afraid what might pour out if he opened his mouth. He didn't want to discuss Cordelia with anyone. He just wanted to see her. If he saw her, he would know. "So," Matthew said, folding his own arms behind his head, "with your new status as hero of the Clave, do you plan to make any demands?" He regarded the crack in the ceiling plaster. "I would ask for my own personal valet and Oscar Wilde to be brought to me for conversation." "Isn't he dead?" said James. "Nothing wrong with the undead," Matthew chuckled. Wait until our next visit to the Hell Ruel. James was silent for a moment. He preferred to avoid the clave. In truth, there was too much they didn't know. All they had been told, by Lucy, Matthew, and Cordelia, was that he had found and slain the Mandacor in Highgate Cemetery with the help of his friends. He saw no reason for them to know more. The situation had been different with his parents, however. When he had finally been coherent enough to tell the story, he had explained it to them, and to Lucy. He had told them the truth about his encounter with Belial, and the way Belial, having been wounded by Cortana, had crumbled to dust. Lastly, he told them of the blood relationship that existed between the Herondales and the Prince of Hell. They had all reacted characteristically. Tessa had been practical and said that she'd been trying to find out who her father was for years, and at least now they knew. Lucy had looked shaken, but said she would turn the story into a novel. Will had been angry at the world, and then gone to see Jem. Jem, who had promised to keep the secret of Tessa's parentage, had told Will that while a Prince of Hell could not be killed, such a serious wound would keep Belial weak and disembodied for at least a century. James had told Christopher and Thomas as well, but everyone had agreed that it was best to keep the details regarding Belial a secret for now, especially as the Prince of Hell was not a current threat. His realm had crumbled away, Jem had explained, signifying a true loss of power for the Lord of Thieves. It was unlikely that James would ever feel the pull to the demon realm again, or ever see it at all. James? His door cracked open, and his mother stood on the threshold. She smiled when she saw him and Matthew, but there was a line of concern between her brows. She tucked a strand of hair behind her ear and said, "Someone is here to see you. A young lady." James sat upright. "Cordelia!" He saw Matthew give him a sideways look, but Tessa was already shaking her head. "Not Cordelia," she said. "It's Grace Blackthorne." It was Matthew's turn to bolt into a sitting position. "Oh, no," he said. "No, no, send her away. Tell her there's a rat infestation. Tell her that vague, insidious behaviour has been made illegal in the Institute and she's not allowed in." Tessa merely raised her eyebrows. She said it was regarding an important matter. Matthew turned to James imploringly. "Jamie, don't. After what she did." James glared at his parabatai. Even now, Tessa and Will knew little of the understanding he had once shared with Grace, and he preferred to keep it that way. "Is it about her mother?" he said. "Isn't Tatiana well again?" "She is quite well," said Tessa. The antidote had been incredibly effective. As far as James knew, not a single poisoned shadow hunter had not recovered. "James, if you don't want to see her..." "I'll see her," James said, rising to his feet. "Send her in." As Tessa went to fetch Grace, Matthew rolled off the bed and toed on his shoes. He turned at the door to give James a sharp look. "Be careful," he said, and departed, leaving the door open. A moment later, as if she had been waiting for Matthew to leave, Grace came into the room. She looked beautiful, as always. Her white blonde hair was pulled smoothly back from her oval face. Her cheeks were flushed with pale pink colour, like the inside of a seashell. She wore a green dress, its hem wet and a bit draggled. It had been raining on and off for most of the day, and it was now late afternoon. Once her beauty had shaken him like a storm. Now, seeing her, he felt only a great weariness, a bleary exhaustion, as if he had drunk too much the night before. He wished she were not here. Not because it hurt him to look at her, but because it didn't. He had thought of himself as someone who loved more deeply than that. "You wanted to talk to me alone," he said. "Are you sure that's a good idea? Your mother..."
"Would go mad if she knew I was here," Grace said. "Yes, but I had to talk to you."
You had better close the door then, he said. He had never been so short with Grace. It felt odd and awkward, but then it felt odd and awkward for her to be here at all. Grace's hands shook as she closed the door. She turned back and, to James's immense surprise, knelt down on the floor in front of him. He took a step back. Grace, don't.
I must, she said.
Her hands were in fists.
I understand why you don't want to listen to me. You have every reason, but I must beg you to do just that.
She exhaled a shuddering breath.
I engaged myself to Charles because I believed that by the time my mother recovered, she would be unable to hurt me. She would find me protected by the consul's family.
Yes, said James. I know. They will indeed protect you. The Fairchilds are good people. He exhaled. Grace, get up, please. She got to her feet, her chin raised.
I returned to Chiswick House with Charles yesterday to fetch some of my belongings, she said. I intend to remain away from home until my marriage. I saw my mother there, and at first I thought I had been successful. She seemed pleased I had made a powerful match. Then I realized she had lost interest in what I had done because she had larger plans.
James frowned. Under her eyes, he could see the tracks of recent tears. Worry stirred, despite himself. What kind of plans?
You know she hates you and your father, Grace said rapidly. She hates her brothers as well. She has always believed that one day they would kill her to get Chiswick House back.
In the state it's in, she'd be lucky if anyone wanted it, said James, but Grace didn't seem to hear him.
When she woke from her sickness, she found out somehow, I do not know how, that you had nearly died, and she believes...
Grace seemed to be struggling for words.
She has always believed that Jessie might be brought back from the dead if she used necromancy. She called upon warlocks, hoping they would do dark magic for her. She begged demons to help her.
James was appalled. But that is madness. To dabble in such things is a near certain death sentence.
She did not dabble. She dedicated herself to the idea, collecting books of necromancy, scouring shadow markets for hands of glory.
But the Enclave searched Chiswick House. They found no trace of dark magic.
She keeps it all at the manor in Idris.
And you never told me any of this, said James.
How could I? And implicate you, too. She is mad where you are concerned. Since she awoke from her poisoned sleep, she has been raging and ranting. She says she knows now there is no chance Jessie will ever return. She says it is as if you stole his last breath by surviving the Mandacore.
What? James's head was spinning. How would that be possible?
I would tell you if I knew, James. She is dangerous, said Grace. She has built herself a palace of dreams and lies, and when those lies are threatened, she lashes out. Do you remember the automaton in the hallway of the manor in Idris?
Yes, though I don't see what that has to do with anything.
It was enspelled by a warlock years ago, said Grace. In the event of her death, it is enchanted to rise up and kill shadow hunters. Now she has decided that Jessie will never rise and that she has nothing to live for. She plans to end her life tonight, and when she does, it will wreak havoc. It will go to Alicante.
James's heart had begun to pound. I understand.